Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
Voiko vanhemmuuteen valmistautua? Mikä vauvakuplassa on totta ja mikä ei? Liberon odotushuone-podcastissa tehdään todellinen syväsukellus vanhemmuuden tiekarttaan. Minä olen Marja Hintikka ja tämä vanhemmuuden odotushuoneen ovi on aina auki, just sulle.
Lives Less Ordinary is the podcast from the BBC World Service, bringing you extraordinary personal stories from around the globe. Search for Lives Less Ordinary wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. I'm Janet Jalil, and in the early hours of Thursday, the 9th of May, these are our main stories. The United States says it's reviewing other weapons deliveries to Israel after it paused one shipment of arms as it tries to stave off any major Israeli offensive on Rafah in the Gaza Strip. EU ambassadors have reached an agreement to use the profits from frozen Russian assets to fund weapons for Ukraine. Flood rescue efforts in the southern Brazilian city of Porto Alegre have been suspended because of more torrential rain and strong winds. Also in this podcast, orangutan diplomacy. Malaysia says it's going to start giving some of the critically endangered animals as gifts to major buyers of its palm oil. US officials have signaled to Israel that more arms shipments could be delayed if the Israeli military pushes ahead with a full ground offensive in the southern Gazan city of Rafah, where more than a million Palestinians have sought refuge from the fighting. The U.S. Defense Secretary, Lloyd Austin, confirmed on Wednesday that the Biden administration had paused the supply of thousands of large, powerful bombs to Israel over concerns that it was about to launch a major offensive in Rafah, a move the U.S. strongly opposes. Mr. Austin told a Senate hearing it was still weighing up whether to withhold other shipments.
Our commitment to Israel's security is ironclad, as you said. Seen from the very beginning. We have flowed billions of dollars of security assistance at very rapid pace into Israel. And so we're going to continue to do what's necessary to ensure that Israel has the means to defend itself. But that said, we are currently reviewing some near-term security assistance shipments in the context of unfolding events in Rafah.
Israel's chief military spokesman, Rear Admiral Daniel Hagari, denied there was a rift with Washington.
The aid is unprecedented. The operational partnership is significant. When there are disputes, and there are, they are being resolved in closed rooms in a matter-of-fact way.
I spoke to our U.S. State Department correspondent, Tom Bateman. So how big a deal is this announcement by the U.S.?
It's a big deal and it's unusual. I mean, you have to go back a good sort of 40 years plus to find the last time that anything was done like this and at least sort of publicly presented. This was said to have been done last week, that a consignment of airdrop munitions, largely consisting of these 2,000-pound bombs, these are massive bombs that are among the most powerful and destructive munitions that Western militaries have. They are capable, really, of wiping out virtually entire neighbourhoods, but, you know, multiple buildings at the same time. Israel's argument for using these kinds of things is that it has to strike at Hamas, you know, below and above ground. But they have been widely criticised, or their use has been widely criticised by human rights groups, in that they've been used frequently in Gaza. So the Americans have picked these specifically and referenced the fact the way they've been used by the Israelis in the past in Gaza, and then saying, you know, as part of the US position, which is that they don't want to see a full-scale invasion of the city of Rafah by the Israelis. That's why they've put a pause, as they put it, on a shipment of one consignment, but have said at the same time today that they are also reviewing further weapons shipments. So this is all meant as a shot across the bows of Benjamin Netanyahu by the administration to try and prevent or stave off a full-scale invasion of Rafah.
So the big question now is, will Israel pay attention? Will it hold back from a major offensive on Rafah? It's pretty bad there already, though, isn't it?
Well, I think that's a really interesting question, and it goes to the heart of, you know, where the decision-making is being made, you know, in the Israeli government. Of course, Prime Minister Netanyahu, as we've heard repeatedly, that he said that even if there is a ceasefire agreement or not, they will still go into Rafah, he says, to eliminate the final battalions of Hamas that they say are entrenched there. I think it's been interesting hearing the response of the sort of military level in Israel today, which has been largely to sort of play this down, to talk about, you know, well, there are differences among allies and that's the way it goes. The Israelis know, first of all, that it doesn't make much difference on the ground because they have the munitions they would need, they think, to carry out a full-scale invasion of Rafah. So there's that practical point, which is a very significant one. But in terms of the wider politics of this, yes, it is the White House trying to put more pressure on the Netanyahu government. I mean, I do think that sort of privately, you know, among American officials, there is a belief that the Israeli government is relatively dysfunctional in terms of its decision making, because you have Mr. Netanyahu on the one hand beholden to his far right ministers in his government who are effectively keeping him in power. He needs their support in the Israeli parliament to keep going. On the other hand, there are members of the Israeli war cabinet like Benny Gantz, a former chief of the staff, head of the Israeli army, who are much, you know, appear to be much more concerned about the relationship with the Americans and what this means in terms of having this kind of schism. So I think that the pressures are growing. The way out for everybody, of course, is a ceasefire agreement. And that's why fundamentally, I think the Biden administration is just doing everything it can to push that over the line.
Tom Bateman in Washington. And shortly after we spoke to Tom, and as we were about to record this podcast, President Biden said that he would not supply weapons that Israel could use to launch an all-out assault on Rafah. In an interview with CNN, he said civilians in Gaza have been killed as a consequence of those bombs the US had sent to Israel, and that while America would continue to give Israel the weapons it needs to defend itself, he would not send bombs or artillery shells that could be used against innocent Palestinians. Well, despite the US concerns about Rafah, Israeli forces are continuing to bomb areas in and around the overcrowded city. Aid agencies say the humanitarian situation there is deteriorating. Medical staff at one hospital were forced to evacuate along with their patients, and the World Health Organization says others will soon run out of fuel as aid is not going into Gaza after the closure of two key border crossings, despite Israel saying one of them has now been reopened. Our security correspondent, Frank Gardner, reports from Jerusalem.
Israel's military operation in eastern Rafah is in full swing, and it's making its allies, notably the United States, deeply concerned. Officially, it's been framed as a limited operation, so not the full-scale ground offensive Washington said it opposed. But there are still reports of civilian deaths. Seven members of one family were killed in an airstrike, and aid agencies are warning of a disastrous disruption to getting aid into the territory. The head of the World Health Organization, Tedros Ghebreyesus, warns that humanitarian operations risk grinding to a halt.
We only have enough fuel to run health services in the south for three more days. WHO has pre-positioned some supplies in warehouses and hospitals, but without more aid flowing into Gaza, we cannot sustain our life-saving support to hospitals.
Israel says it has reopened the crucial cargo crossing point at Kerem Shalom after a Hamas rocket attack there killed four of its soldiers on Sunday. UN aid workers said today nothing was getting through, though, due to fighting on the Gaza side of the border. The other main crossing point at Rafah, on the border with Egypt, remains closed after Israeli forces seized control of it, saying it was being used as a base by Hamas. Rafah is home to more than a million people, most of them already displaced from other parts of Gaza, crammed into a densely crowded area. And meanwhile, in Cairo, mediation efforts continue to find a formula for a ceasefire that satisfies both Hamas and Israel. To date, there is no sign of a breakthrough.
Frank Gardner. Rwanda has been making international headlines after striking a deal with Britain to take in some of its asylum seekers. The UK government insists Rwanda, under its longtime ruler Paul Kagame, is safe, a claim that's disputed by human rights groups, which say opponents of Mr. Kagame have suffered abusive prosecutions, enforced disappearances, or even died in suspicious circumstances. Now, a Rwandan activist and critic of the president has said she intends to run against him in July's election. Diane Rwigara was barred from standing in 2017 and then imprisoned for tax evasion and inciting insurrection, charges she was then cleared of, which she says were politically motivated. I asked our Africa regional editor, Will Ross, why, given all this, she's decided to run again.
She hasn't given away much information at the moment about the sort of motivation behind throwing her hat in the ring for July's election. She's just stated on social media that she is going to run for president. We have to wait now and see if her name will be accepted by the authorities. She, as you say, she has been in prison before on several charges, but she was cleared of those charges. So on that count, she ought to be able to run. But it's a very intriguing case, the whole Diane Rwigara case. She was blocked from running in 2017. So we've got no idea how many people would vote for her. But the whole family, her whole family has had a terrible rift with the administration in Kigali ever since Diane Rwigara's father died in 2015. Now, the family believe that he was killed with the hand of the authorities, but the government there says it was a traffic accident.
And looking at previous elections, a lot of observers would say she pretty much doesn't have any chance of winning. But this election in July, I think, will be different from previous ones in that there'll be much more international attention paid to it because of the British government's plans to send asylum seekers to Rwanda.
Well, yes, possibly. I mean, the spotlight has been on Rwanda because it's been in the news so much, although not so much of a focus on domestic issues in Rwanda. But as you mentioned, you know, she and everyone else will have no chance of winning. In the last election in 2017, Paul Kagame got nearly 99% of the votes. So many rights groups point to the oppression in the country, the fact that criticism is not allowed. Any challenge that comes up to the government is crushed, sometimes pretty brutally. The government denies any human rights atrocities. I think it'd be fair to say that Rwanda has its own kind of version of democracy.
Will Ross. EU countries have agreed to use an estimated $3 billion in profits from frozen Russian assets to buy weapons for Ukraine. The deal was struck by the bloc's 27 ambassadors after a dispute about taxation was resolved. Nikki Cardwell reports.
The Russian central bank assets are currently being held mainly in a Belgium-based clearinghouse, generating more than $3 billion a year in interest. The financial assets were frozen after the Russian invasion of Ukraine in 2022, and there's been a fierce debate about what to do with them ever since. Moscow has threatened the West with a severe response and endless legal challenges if the money is touched. Earlier this year, the EU agreed to use the interest generated, but many countries were unhappy about the 25% taxes and fees that Belgium would collect on the money. Diplomatic sources say Belgium has now agreed to donate the taxes to Ukraine.
Nikki Cardwell. A man identified as a Russian spy is to be expelled from the UK as part of a wave of new restrictions on Russian activity. Several diplomatic properties run from Moscow are also being closed. The British Interior Minister or Home Secretary, James Cleverly, made the announcement in Parliament, as our security correspondent Gordon Carrera reports.
The package of measures is designed to send a signal to Moscow that its recent actions around Europe are unacceptable. The so-called malign activity in the UK includes individuals arrested on national security charges and cyber hacking. The Home Secretary also referred to plans for sabotage in Germany and Poland linked to support for Ukraine and even the jamming of GPS signals used to guide commercial aviation. James Cleverly outlined the government's response in the Commons.
We will expel the Russian defence attaché, who is an undeclared military intelligence officer. We will remove diplomatic premises status from several Russian-owned properties in the UK, including Seacox House, a Russian-owned property in Sussex, and the trade and defence section in Highgate, which we believe have been used for intelligence purposes.
The Russian defence attaché is normally a member of the GRU, Russian Military Intelligence, but he was one of a small number of spies left in place to offer a channel of communication. His expulsion, as well as the loss of the premises, will cause anger in Moscow. It has promised a response.
Gordon Carrera. China has panda diplomacy. Now, in a controversial move, Malaysia says it's going to introduce orangutan diplomacy. The plan is to send these critically endangered animals to any country that buys large amounts of Malaysian palm oil. It's found in many of the products that we eat and use, and critics say that the forests where orangutans live are being chopped down to make way for palm oil plantations. But Malaysia says giving orangutans as gifts to nations that buy its palm oil will prove its commitment to conservation and biodiversity. Our Asia-Pacific editor, Mickey Bristow, told us more.
This was a statement made. The statement about the plan was given by the Plantations and Commodities Minister. He gave general outlines. So, for example, the broad idea that orangutans will be given to nations, major nations of which trade with Malaysia for palm oil, talking about countries like India, countries in the European Union and China. But he didn't say exactly where these orangutans would come from, whether they would be taken from the wild or ones already in captivity, when they would be given, what the terms of giving them would be, any details like that. He just essentially outlined the plan and explained why they were doing it. And essentially what he said Malaysia wanted to do was show that as well as developing its economy and palm oil plantations in particular, the government was also concerned about preserving natural habitats and the places where orangutans live. And, you know, orangutans have become a real symbol of man's battle against nature. So he believes this is a way for people to understand that Malaysia is serious about protecting them.
I think a lot of people will struggle to understand the logic of that, because he's talking about sending orangutans abroad, possibly being separated from their families to other countries where they'll be kept in zoos. What are wildlife groups saying about this?
Yeah, I mean, that's exactly right. It does seem slightly illogical. In fact, wildlife groups, WWF, have already come out and spoken about this. And he said essentially that it would be better to keep orangutans in the places where they live and protect their natural habitats, to protect the lowland forests where they live, mostly on the island of Borneo, which is divided mostly between Indonesia and Malaysia. Better to keep them there rather than sending them off as gifts elsewhere. So from a conservation point of view, there doesn't seem to be a lot of logic in this. But of course, there is a political motive. And the minister who announced this plan, he mentioned the fact that China does this kind of thing with pandas. They act as a kind of soft power ambassador for China all over the world. China sends a panda to a zoo in another country. People flock there. They have a slightly warmer feeling about China. And he hopes that sending these orangutans abroad will have a similar reason. So it seems it's more political than anything to do with conservation.
Mickey Bristow. Still to come.
I looked at it and it had clearly marked down one edge. I thought at first it was some kind of calendar.
So what archaeological treasure did a teacher find in his English garden? We'll tell you after this break. Welcome back to the Global News Podcast. Let's turn now to the devastating floods in Brazil. Rescue efforts in the city of Porto Alegre, which is experiencing the worst flooding in its history, have been suspended because of torrential rains and strong winds. At least 100 people are known to have died in the floods and landslides across the state of Rio Grande do Sul, and at least 150,000 have been forced to leave their homes. The governor of the state has announced the deployment of an extra 1,000 police and security officers to stop looting and crime in badly affected areas, and has called for more help from the central government. Fabian, who lives in Santa Maria City, says assistance is desperately needed.
We had in 10 days an amount of 500 millimeters of rain, and that amount of water was expected in 2 months. We had roads, bridges, and houses, countless of houses, thousands of houses destroyed by the water. Long story short, we are facing a post-war scenario.
BBC Brazil's Leandro Prazeres is in the capital of Brasilia. He explained to James Reynolds why the authorities have warned people not to return to some of the worst affected areas. They've also been told to stay away from the Lagoa dos Patos, which is the biggest lagoon in South America.
There is a fear that this massive amount of water is going down the river and is going to affect the city around this lagoon right now. It's estimated that 1.4 million people were affected by the floods, and at least 6,000 people are now in shelters.
What is the central government saying where you are?
Well, what the central government is trying to say right now is that the central government is taking all measures in order to help the local state. It's important to note that Brazil, it's a federation, so the central government helps the local government in Rio Grande do Sul. So the military has been taking place. There are flights transporting water, food, and support equipment.
What else are people saying?
People are mostly concerned right now with the impact in the short term and also in the long term. In the short term, there is also this concern of violence. And a few days ago, the people who were helping authorities in the rescue operation started to report crimes such as robbery and even stealing of jet skis. Since then, local and federal authorities are trying to reinforce security in the most affected areas. The other major concern is with food, water, and health. It's important to know that all this water might be contaminated somehow, and there are concerns over the impact of these floods and the health of the population. And it's unknown the number of people who have lost their lives during this tragedy.
Leandro Prazeres in Brasilia. The Chinese President Xi Jinping has arrived in Hungary on the third and final leg of his visit to Europe. Before that, he was in Serbia, where he was greeted warmly by President Aleksandar Vučić, and he was also given a red carpet welcome in France, despite concerns that China might be on the brink of a trade war with the EU. Unlike other EU nations, and like Serbia, the Hungarian government has welcomed deepening economic ties with China while maintaining friendly relations with Moscow. From Budapest, Nick Thorpe sent this report.
In a message to the people of Hungary published in the main pro-government daily Magyar Nemzet, the Chinese president flattered his hosts. Sino-Hungarian friendship, he wrote, is like a good Tokaj wine. Fragrant, sweet, rich and long-lasting. In trade terms, Hungary is an important gateway for China into the big automobile markets of the EU. One, possibly two, big electric car factories are planned here, which will help China circumvent threatened EU import tariffs. Major electric vehicle battery factories are already operating, under construction and planned. For Viktor Orbán's Hungarian government, this is an opportunity to show off those investments and point out to Brussels and his fellow EU members how advantageous good relations with Beijing can be.
Nick Thorpe. For more on President Xi's visit to Budapest and its financial implications, Ed Butler spoke to Zoltán Pogacza, a Hungarian political economist and lecturer at the University of West Hungary.
Most of the Western world has been taking part in this process of decoupling from China. Hungary has chosen a very different path. I think Hungary in recent years has very consciously opted out of this decoupling process and has continued to even intensify its economic relationship and political relationship with China. China is a major investor in Hungary, and Hungary is trying to be a exporter to China, but the relationship is at the moment rather one-sided. It's mostly Chinese investments and Chinese exports to Hungary. And in recent years, this has basically taken a leap forward with very massive investments in the automotive sector, in electric vehicles and in battery production.
Yes. Something like I was seeing loans up to $100 billion worth coming to Hungary from China in the last 20 years or so. It seems like a very large number compared to other Central European countries. I mean, what is the factory that's being planned that we know is to be built making EVs, Chinese EVs in Hungary?
Actually, we are talking about more than one factory. BYD has already announced that they will be building a plant in the southern Hungarian city of Szeged. CATL, which is a major battery producer, it will be the biggest plant making batteries in all of Europe. This will be in Debrecen, which is in eastern Hungary. And there is a suspicion that Great Wall Motors, which is another electric vehicle maker, will announce during the visit of President Xi Jinping to Hungary yet another plant, which will be in Pécs, which is in southwestern Hungary.
I mean, it's amazing, isn't it? All of these plants, I saw the Hungarian foreign minister was castigating journalists for reporting on this deal, potential deal, that's the Great Wall car company deal, because the speculation was against national interest. But I think there is this wider context to this, isn't there, that, as you say, whilst Hungary is allowing or inviting all of this huge investment and car making, which must be great, I suppose, for Hungarian jobs and so on, it's happening at a time when the rest of the EU seems to be pushing against the influx of Chinese electric vehicles.
From the Chinese side, the interest is definitely in manufacturing cars within the EU. So if you export cars, electric vehicles from China to the European Union, you face the threats of having to pay huge customs duties, which the EU is about to introduce because of the competitive advantage of Chinese electric cars and the generous state subsidies by the Chinese state. But if you move some of this production into the European Union, Hungary being a member state of the EU, your production in Hungary actually counts as European production from the internal market, and therefore you're not facing any customs duties or quotas, which, of course, it's basically a circumvention of the protectionist policies of the EU.
Zoltán Pogacza, a Hungarian political economist. The pharmaceutical giant AstraZeneca says it's withdrawing its COVID-19 vaccine worldwide. A statement from the company said the decision was purely commercial, as a jab had been overtaken by updated vaccines targeting new variants of the virus. However, there have been concerns about rare side effects of the AstraZeneca vaccine. James Menendez spoke to our health correspondent Sophie Hutchinson. So is AstraZeneca right to say its vaccine is out of date?
Many things have happened along the way. If you cast your mind back to 2020, when our only protection from COVID-19 was social distancing, and then you come to the autumn of 2020 and suddenly you've got these first vaccines, and AstraZeneca was one of them. Now, since then, many things have happened along the road, including the fact that many of us are now immune to COVID-19. And what the company is saying today is that it hasn't tweaked its vaccine. It isn't up to date with the new variants that have come along. And so it is less useful in the world. There is less demand for it. It wants to therefore wind it down.
And it says also that there's a surplus of other vaccines. In other words, if people haven't got immunity, there's other places to go, right?
Well, that's it, really. The Pfizer vaccine, the Moderna vaccine are still very much used in the world. But what happened was that AstraZeneca was hailed as being a vaccine for the world when it was brought in that autumn of 2020. It was made in record time, 10 months instead of 10 years. It was cheaper than the others. It was easier to store it. It didn't have to be stored at such low temperatures. And it's estimated to have saved 6.5 million lives just here in the UK in its first year. So it was hailed as a phenomenal success. But although it was safe for most people, there is this tiny minority of people who suffer extremely serious side effects, rare blood clots.
Yes, what was it? So this is blood clots caused by the vaccine.
That's right. Yeah. Extremely rare, and it seems to occur in younger adults, particularly in men. And so in 2021, the European Union got extremely concerned about this very small number of cases where patients had suffered terrible side effects and died. And then in the UK, in April 2021, it was banned for adults under a certain age, and eventually under the age of 40, adults were not given the AstraZeneca vaccine in the end. It is linked to 73 deaths in the UK, but to put that in context, out of nearly 50 million doses. So you can see that these are extremely rare side effects, but if they happen to you, they can, you know, threaten your life. And there are a number of court cases with people claiming to have been harmed by the vaccine. So all of this really goes into the mix, I guess.
Sophie Hutchinson. Now, it's not every day that you find an archaeological treasure in your back garden, but that's what happened to 55-year-old geography teacher Graham Senior when he was clearing weeds and stones at his home in Coventry in the English Midlands. Not far below the surface of the soil, he came across a rectangular rock about 11 centimetres or 4 inches long. It's believed to be more than 1,600 years old and is inscribed in a rare ancient language called Ogham, also known as Ogham. Tim Franks heard from the archaeologist Teresa Gilmore from Birmingham Museums and first from Graham himself, who quite quickly realised he'd found something very special.
I looked at it and it had been clearly marked down one edge, and it was far too regular a mark for it to have been made by an animal or for it to have occurred naturally. I thought at first it was some kind of calendar, and I think I remember sharing that with Teresa, but it turned out to be a script called Ogham, which I'd never heard of before.
At what point did people start getting very excited?
But I get the impression Teresa got quite excited and pretty much straight away.
Well, let's in that case bring Teresa in here. Teresa, you're the expert in all this. Tell me what your first contact with this stone was.
I think Graham called me to start with and said, I found this rock, I think it's calendar stone. And I said, OK, send me some photos. And when the photos came through, I saw the markings down the side and recognised that, yes, they were regular, they'd been man-made, but it was of a particular type of writing called Ogham. It's normally Irish style, but we don't get them in the Midlands. They're normally kind of over in Ireland, up in Scotland, down in Cornwall area. When I thought it was Ogham, I sent it to Catherine Forsyth up at Glasgow University, one of the country's leading experts on Ogham, and she pretty much confirmed very, very quickly that it was definitely Ogham, and it was a very important find.
And how old do we think the stone is?
We think it's probably 5th to 6th century, but it could be as early as the 4th century.
And have you been able to read the script?
Catherine has done a translation, and she's translated it as Mal Dunkyle S. Lass. So the first part of the inscription is actually someone's name, Mal Dunkyle. The second part, the S. Lass, we're still trying to interpret that. It might be a location of where the person's from, or it could be their occupation. We don't know at this point in time.
Were you aware that people from Ireland were travelling to this part of England?
Not really. So the fantastic thing about this is it's giving us more evidence in our archaeological jigsaw puzzle of how people did move around the area. And it's just showing how people are moving from one country to another, how trade is happening, and this case of how you're getting different contacts.
Teresa Gilmore from Birmingham Museums and teacher Graham Senior. And that's all from us for now, but there will be a new edition of the Global News podcast later. If you want to comment on this podcast or the topics covered, you can send us an email. The address is globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. You can also find us on X at Global News Pod. This edition was mixed by Caroline Driscoll. The producer was Liam McSheffrey. The editor is Karen Martin. I'm Jannat Jalil. Until next time, goodbye.
Voiko vanhemmuuteen valmistautua? Mikä vauvakuplassa on totta ja mikä ei? Liberon odotushuone-podcastissa tehdään todellinen syväsukellus vanhemmuuden tiekarttaan. Minä olen Marja Hintikka ja tämä vanhemmuuden odotushuoneen ovi on aina auki, just sulle.
The mountains are what keeps me motivated in life.
It's where we get to ask ourselves who we are and who we want to become.
At the turn of this century, 5 mountaineers set out on individual missions to become the first woman to scale all 14 of the world's 8,000ers. 14 mountains, all above 8,000 metres.
It was about pitting themselves against nature rather than each other.
They knew only one of them would succeed. But whether they liked it or not, it would come to be seen as a race.
Five women vying against each other.
The media needed to find some competition, and they find it.
A race with deadly consequences.
We are just not designed to live in this environment. Getting down alive was my only goal in that situation.
Amazing Sports Stories from the BBC World Service tells their story in Chasing Mountains.
Every step was an achievement.
Search for Amazing Sports Stories wherever you get your BBC podcasts.